depression. It's one of the most common diseases in the U.S., around the world, affecting as much as 10% of the adult population. Yet depression is a very poorly understood disease. We don't know exactly what causes it. Is it genetics, the environment, a combination of the two? It affects all age groups, we know that. There's no foolproof way to diagnose it. You can't do an X-ray or a blood test to see if someone has it. And in children, it may be especially hard to pin down. And treating it is often hit and miss. Some people do well with drugs or therapy or a combination, yet it may take years to settle on the right drug combination. And many sufferers never find relief even after trying all the available treatments. So this hour, we're going to be taking a closer look at depression. How does our genetic makeup influence the disease? How might the science of genetics help doctors to diagnose and treat the illness? And what role might hormones play? How do you know when a bad mood or a blue mood has crossed the line into depression? We'll also take a look at depression and in children and adolescents. It's even less understood than in adults. And very few drugs are sanctioned for treating childhood depression, but that hasn't stopped physicians from prescribing them. If you have a question about depression, give us a call. And remember, especially in this hour, and especially today, we can't diagnose or tell you whether you're taking the right medications. We can't do that over the air. It's not ethical. So please don't ask our guests to do that for you. I know you want to ask those kinds of questions. If you have general questions, that's fine. Give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Paul Raeburn is the former science editor for Business Week and the Associated Press. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, Acquainted with the Night, A Parent's Quest to Understand Depression and Bipolar Disease in His Children. It's due out in the spring from Broadway Books. Welcome back to Science Friday, Paul.
Thanks, Ira. Nice to be here.
You're welcome. Dr. George Zubenko was a professor of psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine and an adjunct professor of biology at Carnegie Mellon University. He'll be joining us soon from the studios of WDUQ in Pittsburgh. Also with us is Dr. Brian Doyle, clinical professor of psychiatry and family medicine at Georgetown Medical School and a psychiatrist in private practice in Washington, and he joins us from our NPR studios there. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Doyle.
Thanks for including me.
Dr. David Brent is the Academic Chief of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, a professor of psychiatry, pediatrics, and epidemiology, and the endowed chair of suicide studies at the University of Pittsburgh Medical School. He joins us on the line from Pittsburgh. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Brent.
Yeah, good to be here.
Is there an overall, I'm sure there's a definition, Dr. Doyle. Let's start with that definition. What do we mean when we say depression? How do you know what depression is different from just feeling moody today, things like that?
Our problem is that the one word depression covers a wide umbrella of different clinical states. And we may talk about being depressed when we're just having a bad day. When psychiatrists talk about depression, we're usually talking about what we regard as major depression, which is at least 2 weeks of feeling significantly bad, not just feeling down or blue, but having problems with your biological functions, disturbance in your sleep, either sleeping too much or too little, disturbance in your eating patterns, either eating all the time or not feeling like eating at all, disturbance in the capacity to do intellectual work, you can't concentrate, you can't function. And in addition to feeling down or sad, people very often feel irritable. Mm. There are other syndromes of depression, but that's the key one.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Brent, does it show up differently in children than in adults?
Depression is more similar than different across the age span, but children and adolescents often lack the vocabulary to articulate how they're feeling. So often what you find is that they have difficulty with motivation, they feel bored, they're not able to enjoy themselves, they're grouchy, they feel empty. This is the way it presents rather than somebody coming out and saying they feel sad.
Mm-hmm. So it's hard to tease out then from them.
I don't think it's that difficult. It's just that they may not use the same words that adults would use to describe it.
Paul Rayburn, you've written a book about your own family's battle with depression and your children. Tell us about why you wrote that book and what kinds of challenges you faced.
Yeah, well, my son has suffered from bipolar disorder, my daughter, who's now 16, from depression. And following up on what Dr. Brent said, I wrote the book really to learn and to try to understand what was happening with them and to help them, because it was a huge, huge problem as a parent to try to figure out how to deal with this. And as Dr. Brent said, in children, you know, they'll present in a certain way. They might be irritable and so forth. But to parents, well, it's easy, relatively easy for psychiatrists to make that diagnosis. To parents, that often looks like a sort of normal, sullen teenager. And it's very difficult, in my experience and the experience of many other parents I've talked to distinguish a sort of quiet kind of teenager who's going through a lot of teenage changes from a teenager who is really depressed and really needs help.
And so at what point could you make that distinction? Was there an event or some sort of crisis that finally said, hey, this is depression?
There was indeed, and we had a suicide attempt by my daughter, which fortunately wasn't successful. But that's what it took for us to realize that something very unusual was going on. She also went through a period where she was cutting herself with razors and other sharp objects. That kind of thing makes you stand up and take notice as a parent, but that's well along in the course of the illness. So we wish very much we'd gotten to her sooner and to get her help sooner, but it took a real life-threatening crisis to make it clear to us.
Dr. Brent, does that sound typical to you?
Yeah, unfortunately so. I think that one of the ways that you can make the distinction, although I agree it's not always easy, is that if alteration in mood is associated with some functional impairment, you know, with peers, with school, with family, then you need to suspect depression.
Dr. Zubenko, how much do we think that this is inherited, that it's in the genes of not only children but adults, that the depression is going to surface?
Well, twin studies suggest that about 50% of the risk of developing major depression is caused by genetic factors. And adoption studies support the importance of genetics in the development of cases of major mood disorders, including major depression.
There was a study published in the journal Science earlier this year that suggested having a certain gene could double the risk of depression after a stressful event. What do you think about that?
Well, actually, within the same time frame, we published the first linkage scan of the entire human genome for susceptibility genes that influence the development of major depression and related disorders. We identified 19 chromosomal regions containing areas that reached statistical significance for linkage, and our findings indicated that these loci frequently had sex-specific effects, predominantly affecting the risk of depression in women, often work together to influence risk, and typically affect the risk of a spectrum of depressive disorders, as well as alcoholism and other addictions that tend to run in these families. Our studies, which then focused on the area that showed the strongest area of linkage, have provided strong molecular support for the role of a gene called CREB as a culprit for at least one of these regions. Now, CREB's a gene that encodes a protein that plays a pivotal role in cell signaling pathways, and when we examined those other regions that we detected, cell signaling genes were very common in those other regions as well. So our attention is really refocused on cell signaling pathways rather than particular neurotransmitters.
So you think you may have really identified one of the genes that's in trouble here?
Yes, the evidence is strong for at least the involvement of the first identified likely sex-limited susceptibility gene for unipolar mood disorders. And I should point out that, you know, these cell signaling pathways that really operate kind of like the internet for cells are used by all cells, not just brain cells, and that the susceptibility genes for clinical depression may contribute to the development of systemic medical disorders like heart disease, not just mental disorders. That may be why nearly half the deceased members of the families we studied died before ever reaching old age, before ever reaching 65, and typically of what we would think of as natural causes.
Wow, so this spreads out through the whole system, instead of just in the brain there?
There's a lot of evidence that supports that. Of course, there are other models. This is a complex sort of situation where there's likely to be important interplay between genes and environment. I mean, there's plenty of precedent for that in the literature from bacteria to man. So, there's every reason to expect that environment and gene interactions will be involved in the pathogenesis of mental disorders, including mood disorders.
Dr. Doyle, when you talk to people who suffer from depression, they'll tell you a litany of years and years of trial and error with different kinds of medications and therapies before they settle on something that might work. Why does it take so long to find something?
Well, first of all, I'd like to take issue with your characterization of the results of treatment. It sounds like sort of a depressed view of how well depressed patients do.
Well, it's people I talk to. Maybe they'll tell. I'm talking about at least half a dozen people I know who suffer from depression. I don't mean to make light of it,
right,
but they'll tell you it's taken years to find the right combination.
Well, certainly there are people for whom that is the case, but I must say, at least in the people whom I see, and maybe Washingtonians aren't as depressed as people in other cities, that's not the usual course. And in fact, I would say that over half of the patients who I treat for depression will respond well to the initial choice of antidepressant medication. If you look at large populations, about 70 to 80% of patients with major depression will respond to one or another or some combination of the antidepressants. It's less than 20% that don't respond at all. So I'm sorry for your burdened colleagues and friends, but they're not my experience.
Well, let me bring a referee. Paul, in your experience with your kids, was it easy to get them on the medication they needed?
No, it was very difficult with my kids, actually. I'm afraid I'm in the wrong category. We don't live in Washington where everybody's sane, I guess. But we had a lot of trouble, and as I mentioned, it took a crisis, first of all, for us to recognize what was going on. But even at that, my daughter went through a series of, borderline personality disorder diagnosis, bipolar disorder, a lot of things, post-traumatic stress disorder, before depression was what doctor settled on and treated her for, and that seemed to do the trick. And this involved several hospitalizations and a long series of things, stretching over probably about 3 years. So, I do think, despite what some of the others have said, that it is a little bit more difficult in children to diagnose these things. That may explain the problem. The other thing is the question I want to raise, that Dr. Zubenko's really interesting and exciting work on these genetic linkages in depression. To me, as a science reporter, I find this fascinating. I've covered genetics and genomics for years, and I'm really intrigued by what they're finding. As a parent, my reaction is, when, will it be years, decades, or how long before these basic science studies will translate into something that can help kids like my daughter?
Dr. Zubenko?
I think that's a very important question, a very practical question. I would see research progressing really in two ways. The first is a longer-term perspective. My expectation is as we as the techniques develop and as we continue to diligently pursue our goals of gene hunting, we will systematically begin to identify one after another of the genes, variants of which put people at risk for the development of this terrible disorder. My hope and expectation is that by applying the tools of reverse genetics, we'll eventually learn what those proteins do, what roles they play normally in cells, and what the variants do that cause aberrations of those normal pathways that contribute to the pathophysiology of depression.
All right, we're going to have to let me break in and just rudely interrupt because we have to take a break. And we'll come back and listen to Dr. Zubenko tell us some more about where he thinks this is all headed. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about depression with my guests, Dr. George Zubenko, Professor of Psychiatry, University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, Adjunct Professor of Biology at Carnegie Mellon University, Dr. Brian Doyle, Clinical Professor of Psychiatry and Family Medicine at Georgetown Medical School, and psychiatrist in private practice in Washington, Dr. David Bent, Academic Chief of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and Professor of Psychiatry, Pediatrics, and Epidemiology, University of Pittsburgh Medical School. Also, Paul Rayburn, former science editor for Business Week and the Associated Press, and author of the forthcoming book, Acquainted with the Night. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Dr. Zubenko, when I rudely interrupted you, you were telling us about what you think the prospects of, now that we know about the genetics genetics behind depression, where we might be headed with this.
Right. I think research is likely to go in at least two different directions. One is the sort of incremental logical approach to try and understand what the products of these susceptibility genes that are identified actually do in cells and how variants put people at increased risk. That is to say, what results biologically and on a molecular level from the variants in these genes. My expectation is that in a number of cases, those will identify new opportunities for the development of new treatments, new medications that can be used then to interdict those abnormal cell signaling pathways or subsequent events in cells that have gone awry. Now, to address Mr. Rayburn's direct concern, how long will that take? I think, to be fair and honest, it's unlikely that that's going to occur in less than a decade. Although that some lucky guesses, you know, we've identified one gene. We and others have sort of guesses and ideas about what kind of medications and perhaps ones that are not too different from certain medications that are already available might be modified in certain ways that might then show antidepressant effects. And one of the important things here is that we're talking about the potential for developing entirely new classes of agents that work in different ways, so that the issue of being able to identify certain classes of patients with some forms of depression that respond better to particular medications, we're talking about individualized medicine here, might be facilitated by genetics. The second avenue, which might come more quickly, is to take advantage of the marker loci that have already been identified that identify chromosomal regions that harbor some of these susceptibility genes and use those anonymous markers in clinical trials that are used to evaluate antidepressants to see which particular genotypes predict whether a patient is going to respond or not to a particular medication. And that's very important because, as people have mentioned, the choice of an initial antidepressant for a depressed patient can really be hit or miss. And then remissions may not be achieved until they, although as has been mentioned, Dr. Doyle mentioned that maybe as many as 50% of people remit to the initial treatment, that means at least 50% don't and are needing additional trials and medications to eventually respond. That's additional time spent not well, often disabled, and suffering side effects, which all of these medications have.
But you're saying by looking at the genes of the patients, you can tell which drugs might work, which drugs might not.
Well, yes.
And so then you can rule out all these drugs that might not work and giving you false hope about these drugs.
Well, biology is seldom that discrete, but at least probability statements could be made that limit the number of trials and the likelihood of getting the right drug on the first try.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Doyle, how come it takes I'm going to have to use my own personal experience talking with people again.
Sure.
How come it takes sometimes many weeks and months for these drugs to kick in or show results? What's going on there? Why doesn't it start working overnight or the next day or something?
Oh, wouldn't it be great?
Am I right about that one?
you're right on that one. Okay. You're right on that one. The classical time for response, when you have the right medication, the classical time for response is about 3 to 4 or sometimes even 6 weeks. Sometimes we see a response in lucky patients before 3 weeks, and then we're all happy about it. There's actually lots of fascinating work that's going on in trying to understand this, and it gets into rather complicated stuff about what's going on in the brain. These medicines, especially the new ones, do more than just change the availability of neurotransmitters such as serotonin. In effect, these medications, to use a sort of dramatic analogy, are like Miracle-Gro for the brain. We think that the depressed brain is actually suffering areas of cell shrinkage or even cell death because of the depression. And these medicines get inside the cells and foster the development of factors that encourage actual cell growth. And that takes weeks to do. And when we look at it from that standpoint, we think that's really why there's the delay in the response.
Well, does that mean there was brain damage originally, maybe some place in early life that, you know, caused the damage and then brought on the depression, and then now you're going to regrow and fix that damaged area?
It's a complicated business, and I don't mean to oversimplify it, but there are a variety of reasons why you can have traumatic damage to the brain. But we're increasingly thinking that depression itself is the source of cell atrophy or cell death in the brain, and that's part of the reason why after one episode of depression, somebody's more likely to get another one, and after each episode, they're likelier yet to have another episode of depression because you're having brain assaults. In other words, depression is not just decreased mood; it's a neurological event.
Dr. Brent Doyle, any comment on that? Do you think that could we have a psychological trauma? You know, something happened to us and that caused our brain to atrophy in some place and have to be regrown later?
Well, the pathway doesn't necessarily work like that. I mean, I think that what Dr. Doyle is saying is that the brain changes could be a consequence of the depression. And there is some evidence that the more chronic depression, you know, the greater these effects are, which is why early diagnosis and treatment is so critical.
1-800, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, Ira, I was just going to say, I don't know whether any of the other guests are familiar with this, but there's been some very interesting research I've come across in my reporting, which looks at the fight-flight system, you know, the surge of adrenaline that we evolved to run away from saber-toothed tigers and so forth, that in fact there may be situations when children are very young where they're exposed to either to abusive parents or to well-meaning parents who somehow create stressful situations where that system goes into a kind of overdrive and malfunctions, and there's some suggestion those changes may be permanent, and in fact that could give rise later to depression in some of those children.
Mm-hmm. There's fascinating work being done in post-traumatic stress disorder, which is the best example of where something terrible happens and then it has bad consequences, that suggests that there is actual cell death in a very important part of the brain called the hippocampus. And this can now be seen on PET scans, and not PET scans, but CAT scans of the central nervous system. So that, again, you know, psychological events have biological consequences.
So could stressful events in any part of our lives, then, if repeated enough time, bring on some sort of depressive behavior?
Well, that's clearly part of what we think tilts the balance towards somebody doing badly. If you have that happening in somebody who already has a genetic loading for vulnerability in this area, and then you have multiple traumatic things happening, and you throw in something like medical illness, then the risk of depression just starts to skyrocket.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Portland, Oregon. Daniel. Hi, Daniel.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I'm a primary care internist. There's a lot of primary care, and I have been struck by the high percentage of people that I see I diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea who were taking antidepressant medications. And I wonder if any of your guests know what percentage of people who are being treated for depression may have some other disorder, specifically a sleep disorder, as a cause of their depression. Many of these folks actually, once they're treated for their sleep disorder, come off of their antidepressants and do fine.
Dr. Doyle, Dr. Brand?
I don't have precise figures for that, but certainly problems in the sleep area are among the most prominent in depression. And certainly there's been huge amounts of attention in recent years to the major public health problem in this country of unrecognized and untreated sleep disorder, and certainly obstructive sleep apnea is one of the commonest causes for that. I certainly have patients who have both obstructive sleep apnea and depression, and treating the obstructive sleep apnea very often radically improves the entire quality of their life.
Daniel, when you say they have sleep disorders, what do you mean? How many nights they can't sleep? How many hours a night? Things like that.
Oh, well, no. If people have sleep apnea, then their airway closes off and they snore and they feel terrible when they get out of bed. And there are many symptoms of that, such as depression, such as migraine headaches, such as severe fatigue. And very often these folks are being treated for the symptoms rather than the primary problem, which is the sleep disorder. And once the sleep disorder is treated, either they lose weight or they wear a mask, then the other manifestations of that actually get better. And the other manifestations of migraines or the depression is actually a symptom of the other problem.
Hmm. The two problem areas share something very important in common, which is that both are underdiagnosed and undertreated. And I think that it's been helpful in both areas to have some attention paid to the sleep disorders, especially obstructive sleep apnea. And there's been really a big push from within general internal medicine, which I think has been enormously helpful to many patients, so that more patients who are depressed are getting appropriately diagnosed and treated in that setting.
Daniel, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Maybe there's a research paper there for you to take on. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Paul Rayburn, might we ask what the outcome of your daughter's is? How are they doing now?
Yeah, she's doing much, much better. My son, who with bipolar disorder, also doing better. My daughter, at 16 now, has gone through several years of treatment, is now being treated well and doing much, much better. Her main issue to deal with now is problems in school because she missed so much school. She was away in several therapeutic schools for periods of time, 6 months. While those schools did a wonderful job helping her with her depression, there wasn't much energy or time left over for actual schooling. So, like a lot of kids that are in her situation, she's struggling a bit in school to try to catch up to get back to where she should be. But mood-wise, I'm happy to report she's doing much, much better.
Right. Is there a lesson for other parents here, Paul, that you can give us in a nutshell about from your experience?
Yes, I think there is. I would say, first of all, don't do what I did, which was to presume that that a teenager who becomes distant, who, you know, as I think it was Dr. Brent who said, you know, shows changes in mood and changes in behavior, don't assume that that's normal teenage behavior. Check it out. Get them to see somebody. Try to get them to see a therapist or a psychologist, not a pediatrician, because pediatricians mostly do not have the training for this, and find out whether something's going on. If nothing's going on, then fine. You've had a needless doctor's appointment, but if something is going on, catching it sooner can save them a lot of aggravation.
Mm-hmm. And how early, in your experience, did this show up in your kids?
My kids started having problems as early as 4th, 5th, 6th grade, so it seems a little funny. I guess I would have thought before this experience that kids aren't even developed enough at that age to begin to have depression, but it certainly is possible, and I don't think it's unusual that it struck them that young.
Dr. Brent, you agree?
Yeah, I think that even before the full-blown depression, there often is a prodrome of sort of a negative orientation or hopelessness, anxiety. There are studies even looking at infants that show differences in temperament that can predispose to these kind of conditions.
What about medication options? Are the same drugs available to treat children, Dr. Brent, that we have to treat adults?
Well, they have been. I think that's a very current question, given the controversy of the recent British announcement. But right now, in the United States, all the SSRIs are still available to use except for Paxil. But there's been a lot of concern about the risk-benefit ratio, and the British have now said that they're strongly recommending not to use anything except Prozac. Many of us feel that they've overestimated the risk and underestimated the benefit for some of the other agents.
We're talking about depression this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Paul, when the treatments were offered to your children, was it your impression that that these were medications that have been well tested on children, so we know how they're going to react to them?
No, not at all. I was quite concerned about the medications, but as Dr. Brent points out, there isn't much choice. You know, the British concern about the antidepressants is a possible increased risk of suicide associated with use of the drugs. There have been some studies that suggest that, and it's difficult to pin these things down. But there are also studies and epidemiological studies that that show that the drugs do work in a significant number of children and may, in fact, cut the risk of suicide because they treat the depression. So there you're left with a situation where you have drugs that, you know, on the one hand, because they treat depression, can cut the risk of suicide. And I emphasize this because this is the paramount thing in every parent or family member's mind when you're talking about depression. But then the drugs may also cause it for some through some mechanism that isn't understood. The root of the problem is that as common as these drugs are and as popular as they are, nobody really knows exactly how they work. And until researchers are able to figure that out, it's going to be difficult to sort out all these possible side effects.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Rayburn, I just wanted to add that a colleague of mine, Harold Eist, a child psychiatrist and past president of the American Psychiatric Association, was citing me a long-term study of use of psychotropic medications in children that at least asserted that in this population with many, many children, that an increase by 1% in the use of psychiatric medications for the children resulted in a decrease of the suicide rate of 0.23%. Now, that's not precisely the same percentage, but it's a decrease in the suicide rate.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to. I've seen that too, and that's why, as I say, you know, there's concern on the one hand that the drugs may raise the rate, but there are also studies such as that one that show that it lowers the rate. So it's difficult to sort out, it seems to me. But yeah, I acknowledge that absolutely that they're helpful in many, many cases. I don't mean to suggest otherwise.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Doc.
I do think that there's quite a bit of evidence that we have some pretty good ideas about the way these medications work. I don't think that we're simply groping around in the dark about that. What I think is the case is that the brain is enormously complex and the mechanisms involved here are enormously complex. And we're still, regardless of all of our sophistication, at the dawn of understanding how the whole system operates.
Jay, quickly in Tallahassee before we go to the break.
Hi. I suffered from I was finally diagnosed in my 30s with chronic major depression, and it was a great relief to be finally diagnosed, because going all the way back to my earliest childhood memories, I didn't know what was wrong with me, but you know, I had constant feelings of hopelessness, anxiety, paralytic shyness.
What made you go for the diagnosis or get the diagnosis finally?
When my wife left me, I had a bit of a nervous breakdown, and doctor diagnosed me with, you know, when I explained to him that I had had these feelings all these years, and he gave me Zoloft, and within a few weeks it was like a curtain had been lifted and a light had been turned on, and I've been on Zoloft for the past 8 years, and for all those years, I thought about suicide every day, and I haven't thought about it since.
Thanks for calling, Joe. We have to break away and take a short break, so stay with us. We'll take more of your calls and talk more about depression. I want to get into this question about ADD, attention deficit disorder, and maybe any connections with depression there, maybe misdiagnosis. So many kids seem to have it. Maybe there's something connected. We'll find out. We'll talk about it. Stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note: on Monday on Talk of the Nation, a 30th anniversary look at the Endangered Species Act, a review of the accomplishments, the critiques, and future of this powerful legislation. That's on next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This hour, we're talking about depression with my guests Paul Rayburn, Dr. George Zabenko, Dr. Brian Doyle, and Dr. David Brent. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Before the break, I mentioned I was going to bring up something about attention deficit disorder, ADD, this was all the last decade or so. This was the disorder of, I guess, they got a tremendous amount of press about using Ritalin and misdiagnosis, mistreatment, things like that. May we find out one day when the history books are written about ADD that it may turn out to be some form of depression or any link to it, Dr. Brent? What do you think?
I think that they're two different disorders, but if you have one, you're much more likely to have the other. But really, the manifestations are quite different. A kid with ADHD—that's the label now—but will have difficulty concentration, difficulty sitting still, and it's often from a very young age. And there aren't really episodes. It's quite constant. Whereas the difficulty in concentration that you may see with somebody who's depressed is episodic and is often related to difficulty with motivation and change in mood.
But you say they're commonly found in the same person?
And in the same families.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't really understand what the reason for that is, but there have been some very good studies that have shown that they cluster together in families. So it's possible that there are some shared ideologic factors. And certainly kids who have ADHD, you know, get a lot of rejection socially and in school, and it could predispose to developing a depressive disorder.
I'm seeing a lot of adult patients with attention deficit disorder. I think it's a fascinating condition, and the response to treatment is often really very exciting. And I'm seeing the same thing in adults that Dr. Brent is talking about in children, an increased rate of depression in adults with ADD. And looking at it the other way around, to my embarrassment, I've seen with some of my depressed patients who were not necessarily doing well in treatment that they had undiagnosed and untreated ADD. And when I treated both conditions, things really picked up.
My point. We're still very early on in understanding the connection between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's interesting. So they presented themselves with depression, and you found out they had ADD later on?
That's exactly correct.
Huh.
Treated for depression, they got somewhat better, but the patient and I both felt that something else is going on here, and it turned out that the something else was ADD.
So when you did you treat for both depression and ADD, or just ADD and the depression went away?
No, I treated for both. Actually, the people I'm talking about had done somewhat better from their depression, so they were doing better, but they clearly were not functioning optimally, and it was when we vigorously treated their attention deficit disorder that things really got better.
And how did you treat them?
Well, with medication for the ADD and giving them appropriate reading and linking them up with the national organization, CHAD, which is so helpful for adults as well as for children.
Children Against ADD, something like that. I remember what that
right.
was.
Right. Yeah. I forget what the acronym stands for, but CHADD.com.
And they're on the web, right?
They're on the web,
yeah.
Right.
1-800-989-8255 is our number if you'd like to talk about depression and people, trying to talk about it without getting too personal. Kate in Grand Rapids. Here I'm talking to Kate in Grand Rapids. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call and having a show on this issue. I'd just like to make a couple comments and get your guest's response. I have bipolar disorder, but when I was very young, and I grew up in the 50s and 60s, my mood swings, and particularly the depression, started when I was like 9 years old. And I was very suicidal, very depressed, very withdrawn. But my grades stayed good, and my parents really never knew how suicidal or how depressed I was. And, you know, my teachers never noticed. It just never occurred to anyone. Maybe it's because I was an only child, and they just thought, oh, this is adolescence. I don't know. But the thing I noticed most recently is that I had a hysterectomy due to very bad endometriosis, and I didn't go on hormone replacement therapy right away.
And it got better.
It got horrible. My depression was just overwhelming. I ended up with a really very close call suicide attempt. I was hospitalized numerous times. I had to take a leave of absence from my job, and it was horrible. And when I get so concerned when I see the stuff in the media about, you know, the potential dangers of hormone replacement therapy, because women I know with mood disorders, if they just sort of tweak that without thinking about the rest of it, they can pay a real price, and you never see that in the media. And I guess I'd like your response to that.
Dr. Doyle, any?
Sure. Kate's making a couple of really, really important points. One is, and Mr. Rayburn did earlier, that this myth of the trouble that normal adolescence is troubled adolescence, that's a myth. The troubled adolescent, as far as I'm concerned, is a depressed adolescent until proved otherwise. So that this sort of, yes, adolescence is intense, but it's not necessarily depressed. And the other point about the hormonal fluctuations, again, this is something we're just getting more of a handle on, but she's absolutely correct. We really feel that there's a very close correlation between women's hormones and the increased incidence of depression in women. Now, typically for women postmenopausally, problems with depression tend to go down. Mm-hmm. It may be a very different story as it was with her, where there's an acute, drastic drop and change in the hormonal status.
Mm-hmm. So that would explain why more women have depression than men do.
Well, that's one of the things that has been invoked. Yes.
All right, Kate. Thanks for calling.
Could I make one more comment?
Sure.
Is that the reason I really sort of connected with that is because I was having problems with migraines and I was reading all the stuff in the paper, so I went off my hormone replacement and I noticed that my mood was just dropping like a rock, and I've been doing so well. And I happened to be lecturing at Michigan State's medical school on, you know, sort of an anti-stigma thing. And I listened to the next professor, who's a specialist in this, and I went, oh, ding, the light bulb went off.
Could I make some comments about
sure.
this?
Sure. Go ahead. Thanks, Kate.
As I pointed out, a number of the susceptibility loci that we've identified so far have sex-specific effects, predominantly affecting the risk of depression in women. This has interesting potential implications and fits fairly nicely with some of the aspects of the natural history of depression across the lifespan. For example, the first susceptibility gene that we focused on, KREB1, is known to interact with estrogen receptors, providing a potential mechanism for why variants of KREB seem to be sex-specific in their effects on risk of depression. Again, it fits fairly nicely with the natural history of the disorder. The risk of mood disorders in women seems to be greatest at times of hormonal fluctuation, times of onset of periods, times of during the normal cycle, times of childbearing and childbirth, and then where risk is up, and then subsequently after menopause when sex hormones begin to diminish, both in men and women, by the way, where the prevalence of depression seems to progressively drop into old age.
Hmm.
So there's a fairly good fit, at least, between the observations.
Paul Rayburn, did you have that experience with your daughter, maybe being confused this with just hormones going through teenagerdom and waited out?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think one of the things that, as I'm listening to the other guest talk, you know, you've invited very distinguished psychiatrist to be on the program, and one point I'd like to make is that I'd be happy to have my kids treated by any of the folks that are on the show now. Unfortunately, millions of people, kids and adults, with depression are treated by general practitioners, pediatricians, not by psychiatrists. There just aren't enough psychiatrists to go around, and but you don't want to know how much training general practitioners have had in psychiatry. They may have had 3 months 20 years ago in medical school or something, and that's about it. And I don't think that they're very well equipped, most of them, to do that diagnosis or treatment, and unfortunately we're stuck with a system where that sort of thing happens. So I think it's important for people to remember that the people we're talking with on the show here today are not the typical people who they may encounter. These are, you know, really the best of the best.
Hmm. We're talking about depression this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Paul, did you have to actually seek out
searching? I did, in fact, because I'm a science reporter and I have these kinds of connections. My children were badly treated for a long time, and it wasn't until I frankly used my connections as a reporter to get them into places like Columbia and New York, where I live, and to major academic medical centers, and get them to see people like the folks on the show who are distinguished researchers, that they got the right treatment and they were helped. So that was nice for me because I have those connections, but of course most people don't have those kinds
right.
of connections.
Dr. Doyle, Dr. Brent, any comment?
Yes.
Yeah, I do. I just wanted to say that, you know, I'm certainly sorry that Mr. Rayburn had such a hard time getting really good treatment for his kids. It's heartbreaking when you're going through that. But I really have to give a lot of credit to our colleagues, especially in general internal medicine, in the last 5 years. There's been a massive movement from within general internal medicine to improve the recognition, diagnosis, and treatment of depression. And having spent a number of years teaching psychiatry, actually, to family practice residents at Georgetown, I know that there is now, at least, increasing emphasis on adequate treatment and recognition of these disorders in primary mm-hmm. care.
Dr. Brent?
Well, there also are some models, collaborative care models, where you will co-locate a mental health specialist, a social worker, a psychologist, or nurse in a general practitioner's office. And there are now very good studies showing that you can dramatically improve care that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's one of the directions that we ought to go in the future.
Paul, not everybody has your repertorial skills and being a science reporter to have those contacts. What do you recommend for people who have kids or themselves or whatever to find a good psychiatrist who knows about this?
I think whether it's kids or adult family members or whatever, the advocacy organizations are terrific. Somebody mentioned, or you mentioned Chad, I guess, the ADD group.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, which helps people with all kinds of mental illness, National Mental Health Association, and there are all kinds of, there's a Depression and Bipolar Disorder Alliance, I think it's called, a number of groups specific to certain diseases. And all of these groups have information on the web, and they're really tremendously helpful. They can put you in touch with psychiatrists in your area and provide a huge amount of information. At least people have that now. 10 years ago, I don't know what people did without those resources.
Yeah, the Organization for Depression is the National Depressive and Manic Depressive Association. They don't like the title, and I don't either, but it's ndmda.org.
Right.
And in the Mid-Atlantic region, there's an organization called DRADA, D-R-A-D-A, that sort of operates on the Johns Hopkins Georgetown axis that's very useful for people in the Mid-Atlantic area.
Mm-hmm. And is there one great website that has all of this on it? If not, we're certainly on our website. We'll put the links down so Charles will have them.
That would be a really very, very significant public health contribution.
Yeah, and the National Institute of Mental Health also has a lot of great stuff for the public, background papers, basic facts, and so forth.
Does it look like we're making progress? I have about 30 seconds. Dr. Doyle, does it look like we're making progress, or is it just ballooning the problem here?
No, I think we are genuinely making progress and of a couple of kinds. One is that stigma really has drastically reduced, and at least partly because so many people have some relative or friend who's been depressed, who's gotten treatment, and is doing better. And I think that the kids are much more flexible and much more open about this than the adults. But that, I think, is helpful. And some of the things that have been pointed out about the possibilities, not just in genetics, but real options for more targeted treatments, better and different kinds of medications, there's lots of reason to be optimistic.
All right, gentlemen, thank you all for taking time to talk with us this afternoon. I know you all had were very busy. I want to thank you all again. You're welcome. My guest has been Dr. David Brent, Academic Chief of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and Professor of Psychiatry, Pediatrics, and Epidemiology at the University of Pittsburgh Medical School. Dr. Brian Doyle, Clinical Professor of Psychiatry and Family Medicine at Georgetown Medical School, and he's a psychiatrist in private practice. Dr. George Zubenko is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine and adjunct professor of biology at Carnegie Mellon University. And Paul Rayburn, a former science editor for Business Week and the Associated Press, is author of the forthcoming book, Acquainted with the Night, that's going to be coming out in the spring. It's from Broadway Books, and I have known Paul for years. He sits in for me. It's going to be a very interesting read, I'm going to tell you. It's going to be very interesting if you have any questions about depression and his experiences with it. Thank you all, gentlemen. Have a great holiday weekend.
Take care. Thanks,
Ira. You're all welcome. Our program is produced by we had help today. Let's go through the regular credits. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York, and Helen Wigger in Pittsburgh. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. If you have any questions, you want to write to us, the old classic way, send it to Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10020. Have a great holiday weekend. We'll see you next week on Ira Flatow in New York.